John, the other day, I'm on X/Twitter, skimming through my mentions. I don't recommend the activity, but in this case, it was fortuitous. I notice a name that I think I recognize, and it was either a reply or a like, probably a reply, probably correcting something you said in the podcast. And so I click on the bio, right? Link is in the bio, and I read the following. Emmy Award-winning songwriter, composer, Chicago, Manhattan transfer, Mark Jordan, Jay Graydon. And my first thought is, why is this guy slumming with me on Twitter?
Yes, these are a few of my favorite things, for sure.
Exactly. So yeah. I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
But then the name Monkey House is also in the bio. And I think most nerds that listen to this podcast would recognize the name Monkey House by the moniker of Modern Yacht.
Yeah.
So I've put two and two together, and I realize I am now tweeting with none other than our guest today, Mr. Don Brightup. Don, welcome to Out of the Main.
Gentlemen, thank you for having me aboard the yacht.
Ahoy, I can't say that. That ends our... Yeah. So, Don, yeah, lots to unpack, as the kids would say on the line. But I wanted to open with this, because I go to the Monkey House website, and I read one other interesting factoid. Mm-hmm. And this is a sort of testimonial, if you will.
Right.
Monkey House's Don Brightup is one of the very few guys that really gets the melodic pop thing. David Foster, Michael Omardian, Randy Goodrum. It's a very special category. Do you know who said that, John?
Jay Graydon.
Oh, well done.
Did I get it?
Yeah, he's Jay Graydon. Yes. Oh. I thought you had done your homework. So, Don, that's pretty good company to keep, and that's a pretty good testimonial there.
Yeah. I, like you guys, like a lot of musos, have been a Jay Graydon freak for decades, you know. And when I was moving to L.A., which would have been, late 2012, early 2013, somewhere in there, my friend Brian Pearson, who you may know, he's a Indianapolis, Chicago area guy, another rabid muso, knows Jay and said, well, I got to hip Jay to you before you move down there. So we sent him at the time I think was the most recent Monkey House album, Headquarters. And Jay got back to him and said, who is this guy? This is great. I got to write with him. Let me know when he gets to LA. So if I wasn't sure that I was going before, I was definitely sure after I heard that. And, I still had back boxes that hadn't been unpacked when I called Jay and said, hey, I'm here in town, Mr. Graydon. What do we do now?
Stop calling me Mister, was probably what he said.
Make sure you're in phase.
Yeah, make sure you're in phase, totally. And, you know, the only real caveat with work, Jay is 100% approachable, and he's just all about music and chasing the great melody note on the great chord, or the great groove, you know. But the only thing is that you have to work with him when the rest of the world is asleep.
Yeah, we learned that.
Yeah, and I hear from people, you know, like Janis Siegel and Mark Jordan and people who should know that Jay has always worked like that. It was never not like that. You know, if there was a session with him, it would start at 10 p.m. and go through the night. And so that's been my experience too. Almost, and I'm an early riser. And so often when I would work with him, you know, I'd get up at 4:30 or something and drive up to the Valley, and he'd be sort of midway through his waking hours, you know, and we'd work at those hours. But the first time I went over to his place, it took me a few minutes for the nerd to wear off. And I said, you know, I don't want to geek out too much, but can I see the Peg guitar? So he went into the guitar room, which you can imagine is a well-stocked room with, you know, two different levels of guitars hung up everywhere. And he got out this red 335 and brought it in. Let me hold it by the neck for a minute. just so I could say I'd done that.
Yeah, he touched it.
Yeah, and we got down to writing. I mean, I guess he and I now have written maybe about a dozen songs over the years. And that day we got right into it and started working on something that I had kind of a third of the way finished, maybe. So we had a starting point. But the in the early going, the little thing that sticks in my mind was I said, I sat down at the grand piano and Jay's beside me on the piano bench with his guitar. And I said, so who else has played this piano? And he said, oh, David Foster, Burt Bacharach, Herbie Hancock, Stevie Wonder. I said, wow. Oh, holy shit. I don't know if I should touch it.
Yeah. Wow. So a little bit of background. You're sort of leading to my question for the audience. You've got albums under Monkey House listed. True Winter, 1999. Then there's a long gap, which maybe you'll explain at some point. 2012 had Headquarters. 2016, the album called Left. 2019, an album called Friday. And then 2022 is Remember the Audio.
Remember the Audio.
And my introduction to you or Monkey House was, I think it was Inside MusicCast that described you as the closest thing to Steely Dan operating today. Now, you mentioned Jay, you mentioned the Peg guitar. To what degree is Monkey House an intentional sort of picking up of that mantle? Is it paying homage to it? Or is it just something that has come out of being schooled on Steely Dan and others like that?
Yeah, that's a well-phrased version of a question I've had a bunch of times.
Okay. Better than most, I hope.
Yes, yes. yeah, when the thing is, significantly, you left out the first Monkey House album, which was actually recorded in 92 and came out in 93.
Oh,
and I was signed by a great old school record man named Keith Brown, who was president of Aquarius Records in Montreal at the time. They were distributed by EMI, so it was a real record deal, you know. And Aquarius, you might know because that's the label that originally signed people like Sass Jordan, Corey Hart, April Wine, Sum 41, like a bunch of Canadian acts that are sort of, you know, known outside of Canada. Mm-hmm. So we made that first record for them. And really what it was at the time was I was working with a studio in Toronto and we were writing and often producing pop songs for people. And I would pitch these songs to these young pop artists and they'd be confused by some of the lyrics and definitely confused by some of the chords. Mm. And so those cassettes or DAT tapes, you know, the pile started getting bigger and bigger of these songs are too jazzy or quirky or whatever for these pop artists. And finally, Rich Dodson, who I was working with, said, you know, maybe you're the artist. And you should, and all these songs belong together. And let's think about doing a record. And so that was the first Monkey House album. And it now at the time Steely Dan was inactive.
Yeah,
you know. Right. So into the void went I, not thinking specifically that I was doing a tribute or anything, or even flattering myself to think that I was picking up the mantle, but certainly it's my favorite music in the world. It is now and was then. And I had done a lot of, needle dropping as a teenager, trying to decode all those chords and had, you know, done arrangements of their stuff and really dug deep into their catalog to the point where I think I had internalized so much of their way of making music that I didn't have to be intentionally doing it. That's just sort of those are the ingredients that I was working with in my little songwriting kitchen, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could also talk about Paul Simon and maybe James Taylor and a few other people that are sort of obvious, obviously Monkey House adjacent. But, of course, the Steely Dan thing is the one that comes up the most. And, you know, when the first Monkey House album came out, the radio stations up here were getting phone calls saying, can you tell me the name of this new Steely Dan record? You know? So anyway, I certainly don't bristle at the idea. It's fine with me. I mean, I think that those ingredients, that kind of groove construction and jazz chords and kind of literary, lyrical perspective, I think more than one person is allowed to do that.
Bingo.
Well, I think you still hear it in 2019 on Friday. I was listening a couple weeks ago, and I had to write the note, this is Echoes of Steely Dan. And John, why don't you play a little bit of Island Off the Coast of America?
Walking wounded on Bleecker Street, the rhythm pulls them in. Do like you do, the beautiful sound.
So I'm hearing some strong Steely Dan vibes on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Well, as soon as your drummer's doing the Purdy Shuffle, you're you're a couple of paces towards Steely Dan anyway, because right. You know,
no going back.
That's right. Yeah, like people start to hear Babylon Sisters and Home at Last, you know, automatically. But that track was one of my several kind of odes to New York City that have been on various Monkey House albums. And the trumpet soloist is actually Mike Lenhart.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. On that. Yeah. And which maybe adds a little bit of authenticity to the Manhattan thing.
Yeah. And connects to certainly Fagan, because he produced that solo album, Sunken Condos. I think Michael produced that, right?
That's right. I worked with Mike now and then. We, you know, my brother and I put on shows at Joe's Pub in New York, and Michael is often in the house band when we do those things. And at one of them, what year would it have been? 2012, something like that. We were at rehearsal at Joe's Pub, and Michael brought his phone over and gave me the earbuds and said, "Listen to this." And it was a mix of track off Sunken Condos. It might be The Good Stuff, something like that. And he said, "There, you just heard a Donald Fagen mix that nobody's heard yet.
No one's ever heard." Oh, cool.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So what does the a recording session for Monkey House look like? Is it band in a room? Is it assembled track at a time? Is it remote? How do you guys work?
Well, it's always a rhythm section in the room at the same time. Yeah. So it's bass, drums, guitar, and me playing either piano or Rhodes or Whirly once in a while off the floor. And then there's a bit of curation after that as to what the best complete take or combination of chunks of takes is. And once that's assembled, it's time for lead vocals and background vocals, and then usually horns, which is also live off the floor, is kind of the last element. And then, you know, we'll go out sometime. You know, Randy Brecker was on the last album. I didn't go to Randy's house to do that. He just recorded at home and sent it in. And, you know, Drew Zing now plays guitar on every album. And he does his tracks in San Francisco and sends them up to me. But yeah, I mean, 75 to 85% of what you're hearing on a Monkey House album is very much old world, recorded in a big room with a bunch of microphones and headphones. And yeah.
As it should be.
Yeah.
Nice.
No offense to the August Reds of the world who don't do it that way.
Yeah. Well, right. You know what? It's, and I don't mean to be snobby about it, because it's not that, you know, both my kids are in the music business now and they've got a record deal and a publishing deal and they do things a different way. And there's more than one way to skin a cat. But certainly all the music that I love down to my bone marrow was all done with everybody in a room together. So I like doing it that way.
Speaking of which, maybe I could give you more than 160 characters to unpack some of these connections that aren't fully explained in the Twitter bio. But tell us about the connections to, I'm particularly interested in Chicago, Manhattan Transfer, Mark Jordan. So however you want to take that.
Okay. Well, the Chicago thing, I have a band called, a horn band called Brass Transit. And basically started as a labor of love around, I'm thinking it was about 07. And we just got a bunch of like-minded musicians together and said, why don't we just play the Chicago stuff because we all love it. And we thought it might be a thing that would, you know, play a bar once a month and we'd have a good time, you know, and get the goosebumps going as we made a classic noise. But the thing is with Chicago is because they've got like 30 hits, the band sounded good almost immediately. We were super tight and it turned out to be really easy to book. And we got an agent in New Jersey and we just started playing all over the place. And our singer at the time was a guy named Neil Donnell, who was kind of a first call male vocalist in Toronto for years. And Chicago, after a few years, got wind of him. And unbeknownst to us, sent out a scout to a couple of our gigs to watch him. And Neil is now the lead singer of Chicago. He got the gig.
Amazing.
Yeah. So that, you know, that's the sort of organic connection. So Neil and I, when Chicago did their second Christmas album a couple of years ago, wrote a song for them, which turned out to be the single from that album. Yeah. So, and you know, I've since, you know, met and hung with Robert Lamb and now we're talking about doing some writing. So it's a little surreal for me.
That could be a good fit. I could see that.
Cool. And real quick before I hand it off to John, I guess Mark Jordan.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I mean, if you're a musician, in Toronto and you hang in there long enough and you don't suck and you don't piss everybody off, you're going to meet Mark at some point. But for me, his piano player, a guy named Dave Restivo, took off to do graduate school in the Maritimes sometime back in the aughts. And I took his piano chair with Mark. So started doing live gigs with him. And it wasn't too long after that, we started writing together. And we got a song that's current right now. So we've been, you know, writing all that time. And some things have ended up things that he recorded, and some things have ended up as Monkey House songs, and a couple other things were things that got shopped around by his publisher. In fact, we have a song on hold with George Benson right now.
Mm.
So
who knows? Very cool.
That might happen. It might not. But anyway, yeah. So oddly, the song I'm talking about, the one that's on hold with Benson, was going to be on that album, but it was also going to be on my Monkey House record, but both of us didn't record it just in case George was going to. But I think Mark is going to record it eventually as it maybe just as a standalone single. Not sure, but yeah. And then Manhattan Transfer, that was also sort of organic. My brother, who lives in New York, knew Janice Siegel and got her involved in some of our live shows. And when I moved out to LA, Janice said, oh, you you gotta meet Alan Paul, who lives out there. And when they were planning their album called The Junction, Alan and I started, just messing around with some grooves and stuff. And we wrote one of these really rapid fire things that are hard to memorize. And that was on that. Again, I think that's a track two. It was track two on that record. But for years, I think even now they're opening with it when they play live.
So, oh, wow. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to sort of move us into the a little bit of the writing of what you have done. And I took this from Wikipedia. It points out that you've written books, one called Precious and Few, which is pop music in the early 70s, and Night Moves, pop music in the late 70s. We get the we Detroiters get the Night Moves reference.
Oh, hell yeah.
And then you've got writings about Steely Dan. You've written for the Library of Congress, and you sent us this one writing that you did about Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, which that write-up is absolutely fascinating. I wish I don't know if there's a way that we can post or link that out for people to read, but it touched upon a thing that we've talked about a lot, Tom, either off air or maybe even on air, and maybe you can address this, Don. That you talk through this period when Queen was doing this and the creativity that was bursting forth and how they were able to sort of capture what was happening new with technology. As technology was beginning to explode in the recording studio, and we've talked about how I have this theory or observation that you can look at the most creative period in popular music history, and if you were to draw that on a graph, and you are also to draw on a graph the growth of technology in the studio, whether it be the ability to record on more tracks or more rack gear, more compressors, more reverbs, more tracks, new synthesizers, new sampling technology. As that stuff grew, you could see the creativity grow as people grabbed on to these new things. And as it sort of leveled off, and I feel it kind of leveled off a bit in the late 80s in terms of how quick everything was growing technologically, I think we see creativity somewhat taking that same path. So that's a lot to unpack, but you address that in your Queen write-up.
Yeah, and I like that thesis, and it's kind of a pet subject of mine that I don't think a lot of people think about the fact that it's not as simple as Lennon and McCartney come along, or Freddie Mercury comes along, or Becker and Fagan come along, and they just are doing their thing, and it's not era specific. It really is era specific, you know, and it has a lot to do with the tools that they have in front of them for music making. And so, you know, when Queen made Bohemian Rhapsody, I mean, it's only 5 years after Abbey Road. When recording on 16 tracks was sort of an unheard of luxury, and now everybody had 24 track machines, and in some cases were chaining them together with Simpty, and you know the sky was the limit. Walter Becker had a great quote sometime in the 2000s where he said, you know, if Donald and I had Pro Tools back in the day, we'd still be working on our first record.
You never get done. But,
I actually believe that. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that popular art does not move independently of technology. It moves chained to it, really.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got asked to do that thing by the Library of Congress, they have this registry of, I think it's called the Registry of Significant American Recordings or something. Never mind the fact that Bohemian Rhapsody is English.
yeah.
But the guy who contacted me from there, I think, knew about my books and, you know, asked me to contribute that. And I thought, well, what can I say about, you know, the number one classic rock streaming song in the history of Spotify and Apple Music that hasn't already been said? And I just thought the technology angle was a neat way to go at it.
Yeah. And you pointed out that it became a hit four separate times, which I knew it factually, but I never thought of it.
Right. Yeah. It just seems to, you know, there's always more gas in the tank when its time comes, whether it's because of a movie like Wayne's World or the Queen biopic, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's just time for a new generation to turn over that rock and hear all those layers and get excited about it.
And then you also wrote the book Asia, or about Asia. What, we'll link to all the stuff in the show notes, by the way, John, to your point, but tell us about Asia. And I think you're working on a new book now, but let's start with Asia.
Yeah. I'm sure some of your listeners, and I'm sure you guys know about the 33 and a third series, which is, it's now in the hundreds of books. And basically the idea is you do a thin volume, about each album. And, you know, when it first started, they were doing a lot of the obvious candidates like Sgt. Pepper and Led Zeppelin IV and Dark Side of the Moon, you know, all that kind of thing. And at some point, being the nervy little bastard that I am, I cold called the series editor in New York and kind of gave him shit for not doing a Steely Dan book.
And he said, you do it.
And he said,
you think you're so smart?
Yeah. Well, it was sort of like that. He said, you know, well, why don't you propose one and we'll see if we like your proposal. So I did. And they accepted it. You know, a lot of it for me had to do with, I just wanted to get in a room with Donald Fagen and talk about that album. And that took way more doing than getting the actual book deal did. I had to go, I had to go through Irving Azoff's office, and I got after this assistant there, and just, I wouldn't let go of his throat until he gave me a Donald Fagen interview. Basically, I just, you know, he'd open his email at the office and go, "Oh, this guy again."
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, I said, pitch it to Donald. Like, I want to talk about the nuts and bolts of making this record. I want to talk about the Sidemen and the chords and the structures and the production. And I'm not going to ask any kind of stupid Wikipedia daily newspaper kind of
Gotcha questions or anything.
Yeah. How did you and Walter meet? Or do you write the words first or the music first? Or there's sort of like
those kind of, if you were stuck on a desert island,
right. 10 albums.
Yeah. And so finally he relented and the guy, you know, the guy phoned me back and said, "Well, I can hardly believe it, but Donald's going to talk to you." And so I went to his writing studio, which was, I probably shouldn't say where, but it's on a prominent north-south street in Manhattan on the east side. And went over to his place. And of course I was, you know, sick with nervousness because he and Walter were reputed to be such difficult interviewees, you know, over the years, but I think they didn't have any tolerance for people who didn't really know what they were up to, you know? Like Rolling Stone. Yeah. Famously.
Yeah.
They invited Rolling Stone out to do the Gaucho interview on the day that they were working on the delay setting for, You Gotta Shake It, Baby. That's all they did. The guy sat on the leather couch with his clipboard, you know, watching him do that for 12 hours.
Man.
But anyway, Donald was super nice and funny and, you know, made me a pot of tea. And I was supposed to get an hour with him and we went about 2.5. So I think he enjoyed the conversation. And,
fantastic.
It was. And so it was just great to be able to write kind of what amounts to a 150-page record review of my favorite album.
Yeah.
People can find that on Spotify, on Amazon and
Anywhere books are sold, you can get those. Yeah.
And I saw you mention somewhere that you're working on a new book, right?
Well, if you mean the Mark Jordan one,
maybe.
Yeah. So Mark, who just got inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame,
deservedly.
He's written for everybody, Joe Cocker and Bonnie Raitt and on and on. Rod Stewart, of course. He was in his 70s and thought maybe it's time to tell my story. But not a lot of people know this, and he doesn't mind me talking about it, that he's profoundly dyslexic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he told us.
Yeah, which is kind of odd for a world prominent lyricist to be dyslexic, but he has sort of a strange process around lyrics. It more often has to do with him singing things and keeping the bits that he likes and then scrawling those down, as opposed to sort of like as if he's sitting in a comfy chair writing a poem. He doesn't do that. But anyway, it didn't seem like it was, going to be easy for him to write his own autobiography. And so he enlisted me because he knew I had done some writing. And so I just went up to his cottage and interviewed him for about a week and hung out, and then went out into the wider music world and tried to talk to everybody I could talk to that had worked with him, you know, Braden and Foster and Lukather and on and on, you know, just like it's an army of unbelievable creative people, and not just all creatives either, like legendary record company people and so on. So that manuscript is now basically finished and we're shopping for a publisher. So
cool. Awesome.
Yeah, that's coming.
Very cool.
Yeah. Yachters such as yourself will find much
we'll dig
into in there. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to sort of bring this thing sort of full loop. Earlier when we began, you told us about sitting at a piano, writing with Jay Graydon, and you mentioned your Brass Transit stuff. So I want to play a song. I just saw you. I think you may have just posted it on Facebook the other day. And on the backside, you can tell us maybe a little of the backstory of this one. This was Brass Transit, Me in the Snowstorm, and You.
Outside the winter is having its way. Bobsledder's dream coming true. Someone will soon dig us out, but till they do, it's just me and the snowstorm and you.
So you wrote that with Jay?
Wrote it with Jay, yeah. At some point when we were collaborating, I think somebody that I wish I had more of a handle on this part of the story, but somebody Jay knew got a big Christmas cut with somebody. And he said, you know, Christmas music is one of the few little corners of popular music as it now stands where you can deploy real chords.
True. You know? Yeah.
And so he said, maybe all our little delicious nights and 11ths and 13ths won't seem so, I don't know, dated, off center, if we're writing a Christmas song.
1, 5, 6, 4. Right.
Right. So, yeah. And I always liked the bag of that, the Graydon production of the song, Teach Me Tonight with Al Jarreau.
Did you say? A lot to learn. Well, don't think I'm trying not to learn. Since the city,
you know, it's got that beautiful kind of swaying 12/8 feel. So we kind of poured it into that mold. And I think it came out great. I mean, the Brass Transit version is kind of the horn band version of it, but yeah. I really do think it could be cut by anybody looking for a classic sounding Christmas tune. So
Michael Bublé,
there you go. That wouldn't Bublé. Be a bad idea.
I don't know when his next Christmas album will be, but
well, we've got a track already lined up for it. So, yeah. Well, one minor correction before we let you go down. John and I are yacht rockers, not yachters. And the difference is about $600,000 in annual income.
True. And we're both musicians, so you know how poor we are.
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
We don't eat most days.
Yeah.
You know, I had one. I'm lucky. I only had one really, really slow period in my music career. And, I was probably about 40 maybe, and thought, oh man, I could still go back to law school.
Well, you got to be getting close to paying off that Berkeley tuition. I mean, I know that takes a while.
Yeah. Well, fortunately for me, my Berkeley tuition, the school paid for it, but
yeah, that's right. You said scholarship,
but living in Boston, as you know, I mean, at the time, I think it was second to San Francisco for most expensive city in America. I mean, it was ahead of New York.
Complete with roaches too. In all the apartments.
Yeah, I ran a very successful roach motel under my sink.
Yep.
Tell you what, with the positive publicity that Berkeley gets on the show, I should be able to send my kid there for free.
Yeah, jeez. There you go. We are, yeah. Okay.
Jeez, oh, Pete. Mm-hmm. All right, well, Don, this was awesome. So glad to meet you in person, and we'll have to have you on again. Next time you got anything coming out, we'll promo it.
I'm about 6 demos into the next Monkey House record, so that's
okay.
That's right. Coming soon.
Well, when that is going to happen, definitely we want to have you on when you're ready to start introducing that to the world.
You're on. Thank you so much, guys.
Well, our thanks to, let me see if I have it right, Bright Up.
Don.
Mr. Yeah. Donald Bright Up. Okay, I got it. That was great. You know, it's great, these people that you meet, and I hate to say it when I'm right in front of them, but you talk about a buried treasure, this guy.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, I didn't know the name.
I didn't either, and it's kind of funny that you think about, you know, when I was at Berkeley, I always thought of the jazz snobs because they knew all this theory, you know, and it was before I really learned it all. So I guess now they, you know, probably think I'm a snob when I start talking chords and all that. But it is true that once you learn that and you feel that and that becomes part of your DNA, she was talking about that with Jay Graydon, that it's hard to go back and do the other thing, you know. And so they found a Christmas song was a good way to employ all that. And they're right, you know.
Yep. Well, I'm reliably informed that at least listener Hal is becoming a bit overwhelmed with your technical theory. So
I know.
You can
know.
Take it up with him.
Well, I'm glad that we avoided saying funny things like monkeying around or don't get into any monkey business. I'm glad we avoided all of that.
Well, that's what the lightning round is for.
Oh, sorry.
Now that we are in safer harbors, let's get down to monkey business, shall we?
Come on now. That's just too much. That's really ridiculous.
Not really, because my Found at Sea is from Monkey House, the 2019 album that we talked about Friday. This is my personal favorite Monkey House song, and it's called Welcome to the Rest of the World.
Welcome to the rest of the world.
You like that number?
I love that. I love that album. I love especially because I listened to it today in headphones. And remember when we asked him about recording that stuff and how he gets the band on the floor, as they say, it feels like it. You can hear the natural ambiance around them. It's really good.
Yep. I think this is one of their brighter songs, and I don't mean by that recording style, you know, crispness, but it's just like, it's not as Steely Danny as some of the other Steely Danny stuff. So
I would agree with that. Yep.
All right. What have you found at sea?
Well, my Found at Sea is something that I know that you've avoided talking about, because I don't know if many people know that you're an author of your second novel.
I'm also the author of my first novel.
That's true. But it is worth pointing out, The Fatal Flaw is a new book that Tom has written, and it is filled with Yachty references. We get Kenny Loggins referenced. We get specific to the storyline, Baby Come Back. So, A, go read the book. B, it should be certified Yachty novel reading.
I forgot. Yeah, there is quite a bit of myself baked into that main character. But he loves yacht rock. Yeah. And true.
All right. Buried Treasure.
I appreciate the plug. That can be found at Amazon.com.
There you go.
To that website.
Under your name. Right. So Buried Treasure. I sent you this one because it struck me. First of all, this is Larry Coughton from Strikes Twice. So that's probably why I'm saying it struck me. But it struck me as I didn't realize that he would sing on some of his stuff. I've always assumed it would be a different singer. But Larry is actually credited as singing on this. This is 1981. Definitely falls in the yacht jazz area. Greg Matheson on keyboards. Your buddy Paulino DaCosta on the percussion. And this is Larry Carlton's Ain't Nothing for a Heartache.
It seems I found myself a hopeless situation.
Yes.
Right in the sweet spot, baby.
had you not told me, I would have assumed it was some other singer. Like, he's kind of in that Kipner range, mm-hmm. or who's the guy that sings for Lee Ritenour?
Eric Tag,
yep. He's kind of in that realm. Very well done, though. I like that.
Yeah, I was surprised when I went to look it up. I went to look for other personnel, and then it said Larry Carlton vocals. Oh, all right. Mm-hmm. All right, what do you got buried at your treasure?
Well, it's beginning to look and sound a lot like Christmas. And yes. As you know, I love my A Very Yachty Christmas playlist on Spotify. I have a new addition, thanks to today's guest.
Yes.
So I had no idea that Don Bright up co-wrote All Over the World.
Such busy lives now. Life can bring
all over the world. Yeah, co-written with Neil Donnell, Canadian singer who's got some Juno Awards, and yep. as he said, is now the sort of new Pete Cetera in Chicago.
Yeah, that was Chicago, by the by.
Yep. By the by, of course.
By the by. Very nice.
All right.
Off the map.
Okay. So this is something that I had no idea about, and I can't even remember how I stumbled across it. So you remember the St. Elmo's Fire motion picture soundtrack, correct?
I do.
Laid in with David Foster, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm reading from a website called FozFan. So that's obviously it's a website, fan site for David Foster. The original soundtrack of the 1985 Brat Pack hit movie St. Elmo's Fire was touted as one of the most successful music scores of David Foster's career. Blah, 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 peaked at 21. A gem included was Foster's own top five instrumental hit, the love theme from St. Elmo's Fire, which I love.
Yeah, I'd totally forgotten about that one. Go ahead.
Yep. And then Sean Parr's worldwide number one rock anthem, the St. Elmo's Fire, mm-hmm. the Band in Motion song. But there's more on this soundtrack that I had no idea. I would have never gone looking for. But did you know that John Anderson of Yes has a song on there called This Time It Was Really Right?
Not until you sent me this ahead of time. I had no idea. No.
And did you know that there is an AirPlay song?
I didn't know that either. Soundtrack? No idea.
Holy smokes. Yes. So it is not Yachty, but it's AirPlay, which as many people know. So AirPlay is Foster and Jay Graydon, their 1980 milestone album. But this was he was working on him being Foster was working on material for St. Elmo's Fire. He and Graydon decided to resurrect the legendary moniker for a brand new song. And this is called Stressed Out. Wait for it. Parents close to the edge. Close parents.
I'm close to the edge, and I have a fear of failing, the time in between has buried the past, so close to the edge.
Boy, oh boy, you know, that... We did our episode on the day the yacht sank. Man, the tones and the sounds used in that, in terms of yachtiness, puts that absolutely sunken down at the Mariana Trench, man. That is so post-non-yachty sounding from AirPlay. It's hard to believe it's AirPlay. And, you know, it all started when the makers of the Lindrum, which that is Lindrum on there, but when the makers of the Lindrum started making available new chips, sound chips that you could put in to trade out from the original sounds. And the ones that they were putting out were harsh and bright, and they were going for that aggressive sound. And everybody grabbed them, and everybody started using them, and everything just started ripping your eardrums apart from there forward, man.
Well, that's why it's so far off the map,
indeed.
If you will. But
yeah.
P.S. real quick.
Okay.
Co-written by Steve Kipner, who I just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
and Peter Beckett. Of Baby Come Back fame, which you just mentioned. And that lead vocal was Peter Beckett.
Yeah. Wow.
Crazy.
I would never have picked that out of there. I never would have picked his voice.
I would have never gone to St. Elmo's Fire soundtrack looking for an AirPlay tune that also features Kipner and Beckett. So there you go.
Okay.
Good job, Foz fan. I got to check out this site. I might just spend the whole weekend here.
Okay. Off the map for me then, right?
Yes, sir.
This one's just been sitting in the lightning list for a while because it caught my attention, and I thought it was a worthy sound that was close to yacht, but clearly sonically it also has sounds that are of the post-yacht era. And this is 1986. I'm talking about Billy Ocean, the Love Zone album. There's a interesting title.
Hello.
Love Zune.
Keep anyway, it PG-13, please.
Yeah, right. Let's play a little of this. Without You.
Without you, the stars will never shine. Without you, the morning light won't show. Don't you know?
That's a nice strong hook, but yeah, it's, again, it's got that post-yacht sound, DX7 all over.
DX7, yeah, some hand claps. Yep. Yeah. Are you coming around to Billy Ocean more than you thought you might?
Oh, those two, you know, I keep being told by John O'Grady that I need to go back and listen to the old stuff, and I just haven't done that. But yeah, this Love Zone album and Suddenly album, I love. But the song Suddenly, I still skip it.
Oh, come on. You got to come around to it. No. All right. Well, now you can do the thing.
Oh, ahoy, Ploy.
Did you know?